This is Molly Hemingway, encouraging you to listen to my favorite podcast, Issues, Etc. Every day you get in-depth interviews with host Todd Wilkin asking expert guests substantive, thought-provoking questions on all of the important news and issues of our day. The expert guests are in culture, law, ethics, philosophy, theology, and apologetics. Expert guests, expansive topics, always extolling Christ. Issues, etc.
Today, in our modern world, we confuse tolerance with truth.
The commitment to population control and to the reduction of human population would be the most widely shared goal of the top leaders of the world's largest environmental organizations.
When we talk about how Christian nationalists use biblical texts, similar to what goes on with Marxists, they rip passages out of context and kind of weave them together as part of their political narrative.
There is no better evangelism tool you have than the Apostles and Nicene Creed. These give you the words you need to confess the saving faith to others.
Librarians in Michigan love listening to Issues, Etc. And then God's children lived happily ever after. The end.
I think it's safe to say that many Christians in the United States feel disconnected from big media. They don't trust them. They feel like they're being manipulated or maybe even lied to. Now, this is not a new phenomenon, but what has changed with, say, the advent of the internet and then the dividing of our country into two sides with very few people in the middle anymore? Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in on this Tuesday afternoon, the 6th of June. Mark Hemingway is senior writer for Real Clear Investigations, and Molly Hemingway is a Fox News contributor, editor-in-chief for The Federalist, and author of the books Rigged and Justice on Trial. Let's listen to their Q&A from the 2020 Virtual Issues, Etc. Making the Case Conference.
First question comes from John. John says, could you speak to the subject of gaslighting, please, on Twitter, in the media, and from our politicians? Thanks. Molly, you go first.
So gaslighting, the term comes from the movie Gaslight, which is where a husband basically tries to make his wife think she's crazy by redefining reality. And the term has gained popularity to describe how sometimes the media talk about issues where people know what the reality is, but they see what the media say about it, and it's completely at odds with reality. And so, I mean, just right now you're seeing protests that are clearly violent throughout the country, riots, arson, killings, lawless areas of cities being described as peaceful or mostly peaceful. I think that is a great example of how the media can gaslight people into thinking that they're crazy for thinking that arson or beatings are violent. It's a really big problem. And one of the things is that has been bad, I think, for media coverage is that it used to be that there was some slanting of news coverage, but by and large, a shared set of facts. And now it seems like you can't even trust necessarily the facts that are included in stories. That's very bad for the Republic. It's good if people can debate things, have different views on what the facts mean. But when the facts aren't even accurately conveyed, it's very damaging to the media environment.
So when my wife watches the news and she says, am I going crazy? She asks that question. She's getting that sense of the gaslight process.
Right, and it's not just in one story. It can be in a whole series of stories where basic reality is denied. And it's particularly effective, I think, in more complex stories. Yesterday, we heard Katie Faust talk about all the ways in which fatherhood is so important for the family. And it's common sense. It's really something we all have experienced and witnessed, that it's important for fathers to be raising their own children. And that is not even included as part of a discussion when we're talking about really complicated issues right now, that came out of the George Floyd killing. And that doesn't even get mentioned. And it can make someone feel like they're going crazy, that the thing that is like probably the biggest reason for people going to jail, people having interactions with police officers, people getting addicted to drugs, people not having college success, just isn't mentioned at all.
Mark, what do you think?
Well, so there's a lot that goes on here with gaslighting, but I think one thing that's interesting about it is, like, as Molly pointed out, the original term was to, like, convince a person that they were crazy. And, like, the thing what's going on with the media in particular right now is I don't think they're convincing anyone. That's the problem, is it makes everything about, you know, the information system in this country, which is already highly asymmetric toward one point of view, look like it's being deployed not for any sort of public good that we would normally expect in the journalism industry, but specifically to achieve certain powerful political ends. So, like, you end up with a situation here in the past couple of months, like the COVID response was a classic example. You had a couple dozen protesters at, a handful of state capitals around the country protesting lockdowns. And it was just a blanket of media coverage about how dangerous this was, that anyone was out in public, you know, protesting outdoors or whatever. A few of them were carrying guns and it was super scary. The media turned on a dime, like within a week or two, when there were mass protests with people shoulder to shoulder outdoors and crowds by the thousands. They had public health experts, signing, petitions saying that, oh, no, this is actually perfectly fine in the middle of a pandemic. I mean, who on earth believes that people are acting in good faith when you see that kind of flip-flop in such a short span? I don't even know what to say about that. I mean, it's kind of frustrating. But also, a couple of years ago, I think Trump first trotted out the phrase, the media is the enemy of the American people. Fake news is the enemy of the American people, sorry. And people, interpreted that as this horrible attack on the media. And even I bristled initially. I mean, I know that there are lots of good people within the media industry that are, doing their, vocational best. But these days, I hesitate to use the word enemy, and I still bristle at that. And I don't think it's a helpful way of thinking at it. But when you see things like that, we see that kind of naked flip-flop for political ends, and it's happening, like, with regularity. I honestly don't know what to say. I mean, it's really destructive, to, sort of the fabric of American society.
Nathan says, I think I was looking forward to interacting with these two people the most. So thanks for passing questions along. I would really love to hear them both discuss political journalism in light of the Eighth Commandment. In particular, not just being factually truthful, but also putting the best construction on any ambiguities of our neighbor's words and actions. Molly, you go first.
Well, first, I just want to say that I'm also sad that we can't all be together in person, because we were very much looking forward to not just hearing from people who are speaking, but one of the things I think is best about these Issues Etc. conferences is that you get to interact with so many people from across the country. And it's just fun and really helpful for Mark and me, because we have a great congregation and we have a great church home, but there's just nothing like being able to go out and speak on these issues with an audience that is a little different than the normal audience that we're speaking with. So we look forward to being able to interact in person next year when knock on wood, this is all done. As for political journalism and the Eighth Commandment, I do think that's just a problem with all journalism. It's very difficult to remember to put the best construction on everybody when you are covering them. But it's actually a good journalistic trick, is to try and understand the motivation of each person that you're talking to, and to really get the best version of whatever it is that they're saying into your stories. It makes all arguments stronger. I mean, Mark and I come out of just straight news writing, but then we became opinion journalists. It still is important for opinion journalists to understand the arguments that they're going against, and to accurately and fairly convey them. And it is something that I think is appreciated by people across the political spectrum. It's not something that you see happen very often.
Yeah, I obviously agree with everything Molly just said, and she's absolutely right. It's always best to include the strong form of your opponent's arguments as opposed to, the weak form. You generally have enough, maybe not everybody reading your story is incredibly informed on the details of maybe some complex policy issues, but there are also enough people out there reading you that are. And, over time, that negatively impacts your reputation as a journalist or your institutional reputation, as the case may be for the New York Times or the Washington Post, where you have major journalistic institutions, I think, that have so neglected the strong form of the argument or even opposing views on major issues One of the things we've seen in the last 20 years is sort of the embrace of nakedly ideological journalism in places where it wasn't always the case, and specifically deciding that certain issues couldn't be debated. And I think there was a notorious Washington Post column, like, by their ombudsman, which I don't think they even have an ombudsman anymore. I don't think New York Times is not an ombudsman anymore, but the Washington Post ombudsman, like, what was it, like 12 years ago, wrote a piece basically saying, well, we don't have to include any opposition opinion on gay marriage battles because those people are awful. I mean, that was literally the position that they adopted. And we increasingly see this in journalism, like, well, we don't need to include an opposing opinion because, you know, the opposing opinion is bad. Most recently, there was this controversy over the Tom Cotton op-ed in the New York Times, where Tom Cotton wrote an op-ed in favor of deploying federal troops, if necessary, to cities to restore order in the middle of, you know, there were, like, you know, riots and I don't know how many hundreds of cities doing billions of dollars of damage. And this was an opinion that was, according to public opinion polling, showed that a majority of the country and something like 40% of African Americans supported using federal troops if necessary to restore law and order in these cities. And the entire New York Times, institution New York Times, revolted. And not only did they revolt, their line on it was, running this op-ed literally puts the employees of this paper in danger. And I mean, if you're at a point where you're saying the opposing view, which is held by a majority of the American people, you know, literally, you know, words on paper is physically threatening to your corporeal form. I mean, how do you even begin to have the debate in that circumstance? How do you have the kind of democratic competition of ideas that's necessary to come up with the best solutions? You know, maybe putting federal troops on the streets isn't the best solution, but it's something that needs to be debated, at least in a situation where law and order is breaking down that much. But we can't do that.
We will get to what's going on at the New York Times as we listen to Mark and Molly Hemingway's Q&A from the 2020 Virtual Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference next. Thanks to our beloved on-demand listeners, Issues Etc. consistently ranks among the top podcasts in religion and spirituality. You can help us climb the charts by subscribing, rating, and reviewing Issues Etc. Type Issues Etc. in your podcast provider, hit the subscription button, and leave us a 5-star review. This will make it easier for podcast listeners to find Issues Etc. Help us cast Christ's net on the internet. Subscribe, rate, and review Issues Etc. today.
We preach Christ crucified. That's the theme of the 68th Convention of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod that's gathering this summer in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Christ crucified is the sum and content, the substance of everything we preach and proclaim. At convention, delegates will gather to worship, hear God's word, and discuss the business of synod. To learn more about the upcoming convention, pick up a copy of the June-July issue of the Lutheran Witness. Visit cph.org/witness to subscribe or witness.lcms.org to learn more. The Lutheran Witness, helping you interpret the world from a Lutheran perspective.
Your lifeline to the Lutheran worldview. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Hello, this is Pastor Curtis Brooks with Lamb of God Lutheran Church in Papillion, Nebraska. We are faithful to the Lutheran confessions as recorded in the Book of Concord, and our services are traditional Eucharistic liturgies in accordance with the ancient text. We gather Saturday evening and Sunday morning, and if you're ever in the Omaha area, come visit us in Papillion. Our website is lambofgodlcms.org.
For your next family vacation, consider Our Beach House, a charming 3-bedroom vacation rental on beautiful Siesta Key. Just off Sarasota, Florida, Siesta Key Beach, consistently voted America's best, is just 100 steps away. Whether you're watching the sunset over the Gulf of Mexico or frolicking in the warm surf, you and your family will fall in love with Siesta Key. Check us out at SiestaKeyRentalGenie.com or call Virginia at 941-266-1858.
We're listening to a Q&A with Mark and Molly Hemingway from the 2020 Virtual Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Up next, what's going on at the New York Times?
In that vein, there has been kind of a cascade in New York media following the Tom Cotton op-ed. There was Bennett's resignation, there was Barry Weiss's resignation, and then as kind of collateral damage that had been brewing for a while, Andrew Sullivan left his post there in New York media. Molly, what do you think is going on? New York is, in a lot of ways, for, along with Washington, D.C., for most Americans, the media. What's going on?
Well, a very bad thing is going on where the range of tolerated opinion in many New York and to a lesser extent, but still present DC newsrooms and opinion rooms is just becoming very constricted. And there's almost a religious zeal and enforcement of progressive orthodoxy in these newsrooms, as Mark just mentioned about the Tom Cotton op-ed, which completely destroyed the New York Times as a functioning editorial page, and Barry Weiss left soon thereafter because of the hostile work environment. I do want to point out that one thing that she put in her letter, which is really worth reading. I mean, Barry Weiss is a liberal herself. She is not a conservative. She does not hate conservatives, but she is not conservative. And yet, because she is opposed to anti-Semitism and a few other issues, she could no longer stay at the New York Times. And her letter really did highlight the anti-Semitism in the newsroom that is tolerated or in the New York Times that is tolerated. And I do worry about that. There's something about the current racial and racist environment that is starting to speak in such a way that a lot of Jewish people are concerned. They have seen before where when you scapegoat particular groups of people, it can kind of quickly lead to scapegoating in particular and in a more violent way, Jews. And I think that was something that was particularly concerning to her and should have been engaged with more. But just in general, these are not places where you can have healthy debates, New York Magazine, New York Times, and other places. And that is a really big problem. I would also just say, if you have a newspaper like the New York Times that cannot tolerate a Tom Cotton op-ed that is held by a majority of the American people or someone as liberal as Barry Weiss, there is no need, I believe, for anybody who is not far left to consider the New York Times a real newspaper or any sort of place that you need to take seriously. And I'm a little bit surprised that so many political people, like politicians, right of center, continue to treat that newspaper as if it's a legitimate place. It is not legitimate, and there's no need that you should ever cooperate with their reporters so long as they tolerate this restriction of a viewpoint, and so long as they are as hostile as they are to conservatives, what they believe, and who represents them.
Yeah, and just to add to what Molly just said, there was, when they were rejecting the Tom Cotton op-ed and the employees were protesting, one of the things the employees said that they said that they had sources that weren't going to work with them if they ran with the Tom Cotton op-ed. And that was, you know, really damaging to the institution. I mean, like, they're totally oblivious to how half the country views and interacts with the paper in that regard. And, you know, everything Molly just said about what Barry, you know, did, I think, is absolutely accurate. I think anti-Semitism is a horrible problem right now. No one's talking about it because it's just politically incorrect in too many ways. But it's a serious problem that needs to be addressed. But I also wanted to add to that, Barry also said something in a resignation letter about how, you know, the paper was basically, you know, as a de facto matter, was being sort of edited by Twitter. And this is a huge, huge problem. I mean, if someone were to start a newspaper tomorrow and say that their selling point was that we refuse to let all of our reporters on social media, I would pay through the nose for that in a heartbeat. Because right now what's going on here is we have a situation where once you're a reporter and you land at the New York Times and all of a sudden you get 500,000 Twitter followers, you have a brand unto yourself, and all of a sudden you're no longer accountable to the institution. Like, the institution is like trading off of your notoriety and your individual brand, but your individual brand and your individual politics may conflict with what's best for the institution. And particularly among younger reporters who have been, who, you know, came out of, you know, elite colleges and things like that, that have more radical politics, like, they're just completely blind to the fact that they're out of step with the mores of most of the country, and they are willing to sort of like tank the institution, you know, in order to serve their personal brand. And they have this idea that somehow once the inmates are running the asylum, you know, they'd be able to use the institution to their own ends. But I got news for them. I mean, the New York Times is like, it's rapidly diminished its own institutional reputation in just the past couple of months. I mean, they've done just crazy, outrageous things. I mean, they ran an op-ed saying that if your parents don't support the same, you know, racial causes as you do, and don't give money to, you aren't protesting in the streets or writing checks to anti-racist organizations, you should cut off all contact with them. I mean, at a certain point, you know, people are looking at these, you know, one extreme thing after another. And I just don't think, you know, 5-10 years from now, if they head down this path, the New York Times is going to be the New York Times.
Keith asks this. Terry Mattingly, of mutual acquaintance and a regular guest on Issues, etc., recently alluded to the idea that editorial boards, for example, the New York Times, seem to have begun asserting that their job is to promote a party line, in other words, proselytizing. My word, says Keith, not Terry's. How do news consumers sift through the proselytizing and glean facts? I would ask, in addition, can they? Molly.
It is interesting to note that the New York Times created the modern editorial page explicitly to bring in viewpoints that differed from the newspaper. We have this idea of newspapers that their job is to be objective, and in the news pages, they just write straight news, and then on the editorial page, they express their opinion. It actually hasn't always been that way. Newspapers used to be pretty opinionated in their news sections as well. The New York Times really pioneered this idea that their news pages would be just objective. They would bring in these viewpoints to go against their house editorials. And now that is over. The New York Times has explicitly said, we will not run editorials that we don't agree with. And so now when they write their crazy, when they publish these crazy op-eds, you can take it to the bank that that's the official position of the New York Times. I am far more concerned than what's happening at the editorial page by what's happening in news pages. In news pages, that old idea that we had for a few decades of aiming toward objectivity has just been completely thrown out the window. As Mark pointed out with the idea that in order to redefine marriage, they weren't even going to explain accurately what the position in support of marriage as a natural institution based on sexual complementarity was. I mean, they just didn't even include it, and we saw the results of that. They don't report accurately in any way on major issues, whether it's abortion or religious liberty or kind of anything. And it's the news pages becoming so opinionated, just asserting things that can be conspiracy theories, asserting what people believe based on no evidence. That is much more destructive, I think, to journalism than whatever craziness is happening on editorial pages.
Yeah, it is a huge problem. I mean, I do think that you should, and I, this is a generalization, but I think it bears out. And again, I mean, even 5-10 years ago, it would have sounded crazy that I'd be saying this, but I mean, I think it is the case. You have to view the explicit goal of most of the major journalistic institutions in this country as electing Democrats. And when they aren't electing Democrats, they're trying to push the Democratic Party further left. I mean, that full stop. I mean, there are obviously, you know, some exceptions, the Wall Street Journal editorial page, for instance. But even there at the Wall Street Journal just this week, a bunch of news reporters, you know, petitioned the publisher saying that the opinion section is, you know, dangerously inaccurate in pushing all of these, you know, bad ideas, you know. And as a subscriber to the Wall Street Journal, it's absurd. I mean,
we do subscribe to the Wall Street Journal. I was reading it a few weeks ago. The editorial page had this really healthy debate on statue destruction and what the meaning is of that, and you know, what's happening in the country. And I realized I hadn't read a single word about those riots in the news pages before I got to the editorial page.
Yeah,
stunning.
Now,
several of our conference attendees are asking this question. It's typified by Natalie, who says, how do we get journalism back? First Amendment free press and the truth being oppressed just by the sheer size and scope of mainstream journalism. Molly, how do we do it?
Well, I do think it's important for people who understand the importance of truth and being accurate and putting the best construction on all viewpoints to enter the field of journalism. And the good news about what's happening right now, there are more opportunities than ever before to do good, proper reporting and opinion journalism. I myself started a publication 7 years ago. I helped start that with my colleagues, The Federalist, where we publish news and opinion. And we wouldn't have been able to do that if the, you know, if the internet hadn't taken off the way it did and whatnot. There are many outlets where you can do that. I think it's really important that Christians not consume or reward news sites that do not, I think it's important for Christians to not reward news sites that are hostile to them. And I think it's difficult to realize how hostile major media environment is, but there need to be incentives for and disincentives for what they have been doing.
We'll talk about voting with our subscriptions when we continue with the Q&A from the 2020 Virtual Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference with Mark and Molly Hemingway next. Pastor Matt Harrison, president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, is the author of the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, Take Courage, Encouraging Words for Discouraging Times. This new resource reminds discouraged Christians of the one thing right in the world, the person who alone has overcome the world. Find out more about Take Courage at issuesetc.org or by calling Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. Take Courage by Pastor Matt Harrison, the Issues Etc. Book of the Month.
Register today. The 2023 Lutherans for Life National Conference is October 11th through the 13th at the Holiday Inn Cincinnati Airport in Erlanger, Kentucky. The conference includes visits to the Ark Encounter and Creation Museum. Online registration is open now with early bird pricing at lutheransforlife.org/conference. Lutherans for Life, equipping Lutherans and their neighbors to be gospel-motivated voices for life. lutheransforlife.org.
Deaconesses are women trained to share the gospel of Jesus Christ through works of mercy, spiritual care, and teaching of the Christian faith. The word deaconess means servant. Find out more on how you can serve in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod through the vocation of deaconess at lcms.org/deaconess. Working in faith, laboring in love, remaining steadfast in the hope of our Lord Jesus Christ. LCMS Deaconess Ministry. lcms.org/deaconess.
Faith Lutheran Church and School in Plano, Texas preaches Christ crucified. Join us each Lord's Day to hear law and gospel preaching and to receive the Lord's Supper. Our classical preschool through grade 12 Lutheran school is second to none. The school serves home educators too with online classes in the high school. We are located at 1701 East Park Boulevard in Plano, Texas. Reach us by phone at 972-423-7448 or on the web at www.flsplano.org.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Our school is committed to authentic Lutheranism, the entire Book of Concord, and indeed to authentic Lutheranism as it has continued to be confessed and practiced through the centuries right up into our own time.
Dr. Cameron McKenzie, chairman of the Department of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
We're committed then to biblical, confessional Christianity and Lutheranism and applying it to the world of today in as effective a way as we can.
You can find out more about studying for the pastoral ministry at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, at ctsfw.edu, ctsfw.edu, or call 1-800-481-2155, Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. We're listening to a Q&A from the 2020 Virtual Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference with Mark Hemingway of Real Clear Investigations and Molly Hemingway
of the Federalist. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Here's Molly talking about voting with our subscriptions.
Yeah, Matt Walsh, I think, said something last night. And again, I bristle against this, and this is not my first inclination, but absolutely, we need to start voting with our dollars to some extent to at least affect some sort of change to these institutions to make it clear that if they keep going down this path, then they're going to be, in trouble financially or otherwise. I mean, there's a whole tangent I could go off in here about how the internet destroying newspaper business models has also led to a lot of this ideological change, somewhat inadvertently. But, by and large, we need to sort of align their financial incentives with, the incentives of public service journalism, which are clearly skewed at this point in time. But I do have one note of caution, which is just simply to say that, yeah, the Federalist is fantastic, and we need more, outlets like that, whether they're ideological or not. I mean, there are principled outlets on the left. I mean, the Intercept is a left-wing publication that does a lot of, says a lot of crazy things that I even find offensive, but at the same time, they do a lot of great reporting, and they're principled, and I appreciate that. But we also have this problem, which is to say, we only have a couple of institutions left in this country, for instance, that can do reporting on China and what's happening to the Uyghurs. And that includes, like, the Washington Post and the New York Times, which are quickly becoming almost unsalvageable ideologically. But at the same time, like, they have the resources to do that kind of in-depth international reporting. And I don't know what to say. Once you destroy those kinds of institutions, we're going to be worse off for it on some level.
Molly, Angela in Illinois asks, next to the Federalist, where does an average American like me turn to get the most objective news reports? So we've talked a little bit about this. Where would you suggest people go for as close to straight news as you can get today?
I would still recommend the Wall Street Journal, troubled though it might be. I have been, I would not recommend the Washington Post or New York Times. And further, I just had another idea based on the last question, which is politicians or leaders should not reward these newspapers for doing what they're doing to the country. And so I think one way that Christians can have a voice is when they see a politician kowtowing to the New York Times or the Washington Post, to criticize them for that. Because as leaders who are supposed to be representing voters, when those politicians work so hard to be beloved by these newspapers, that is very damaging to Christians, to conservatives. And so holding those people accountable, I think, is important. But where I get my news is I curate a Twitter feed. I'm not recommending this for people because generally Twitter is probably not a great place for people to be. It makes people bad. But I curate reporters who I trust, and I see what they are linking to. And I read the Wall Street Journal. And I also go to Real Clear Politics, which is related to Mark's site. They have an aggregation on their front page, realclearpolitics.com. They update it like 3 times a day. And they get viewpoints from left, right, and middle. And when you read, since everyone's kind of becoming opinion journalists as opposed to straight news, when you get a balance of opinions, you can kind of figure out a little bit better what's actually happening.
Yeah, I don't have a lot to add to that. I mean, everything Molly said is great, but the unfortunate aspect of it is that you kind of have to become a professional news consumer. I mean, like Molly says, you have to have a file of like journalists that you consider reliable and remember their names and that sort of thing and keep track of it. And people have a low tolerance for that sort of thing, or they don't have the bandwidth to do it. And I don't blame them. I can barely keep up, and I do this for a living.
Actually, isn't that, I think there might be an argument. I read this great piece yesterday in Public Discourse about not reading the news, which is a total argument against interest for Mark and me being in the news business. But it was saying that to be educated, you really should be not on Twitter, not seeing what the tiny updates are, but reading real things, real books that give you big ideas, studying scripture more than you are studying, what the newspaper says might benefit you more.
I totally agree with that. And I just wanted to say that, like, I think it was Calvin Coolidge who famously had this metaphor that like governing was like standing at the bottom of a hill where there's a bunch of boulders rolling toward you. I mean, the reality is most of these big lumbering boulders aren't going to get anywhere near you. And, if you have enough time, you can just, sort of step out of the way of these boulders. And part of what goes on with the 24-hour news cycle now is they deliberately, their business model is to make you anxious, is to make you care about things that you shouldn't necessarily obsess about. And you need to have the kind of perspective that comes from from sort of stepping back and understanding issues in the big picture. And unfortunately, like Molly said, people don't read books and stuff as more. They don't go to church. They don't have a moral clarity to viewing the news. So yeah, every little thing they're told is going to destroy their life, and they get anxious, and it feeds into this monstrous machine.
Let's turn to politics. Paul in Chicago says, in 4 months or 4 years, we'll have a post-Trump Republican Party. What does the party look like post-Trump? Molly.
That's a good question. And I do believe that Trump has been a transformative president for the Republican Party. I actually think it might have been Mitt Romney who helped transform the party the most, in that people nominated Mitt Romney, 8 years ago? And they didn't particularly love him, but they were willing to work really hard to get him elected. And the first thing to remember about the Mitt Romney candidacy is that he was, whatever else you want to say about him, seemed like a pretty nice and decent guy. And the media portrayed him as worse than Hitler. I think that was a radicalizing moment for a lot of right of center voters, where they realized you could nominate even a man like Mitt Romney, and the media would claim that he was a disaster and Hitler and horrible.
The Obama campaign literally said for months, and the media basically bought into this idea that he was committed felonies and gave people cancer. I mean, these were like real things in the campaign.
The other issue about this is, I think perhaps because Republicans tend to be, they're churchgoers, religious, they very much value being nice, and they saw how that was weaponized, and also that they were electing people based on, or nominating people based on, the idea of how nice they were, which would sometimes result in having people who turned the other cheek when they were called Hitler without realizing that they were turning the cheek and allowing everyone else they represented to be destroyed. And I think it was a change for a lot of conservatives, realizing they did need someone, that they have people who are trying to destroy them, people who are trying to take away religious liberty, take away their freedoms, and they need, or they desire, someone who will fight for them. So I think that has been a major change in the Republican Party. I don't know if the Republican Party establishment realizes that their old way of doing things, which is sort of like to weakly fight on behalf of their voters, is over. I actually think that if Trump loses, it will be a bloodbath for that type of Republican. Whether it's 2 years or 4 years, those people will get primaried, they will lose their nominations, and that will happen sooner if Trump loses and later if he wins.
I think obviously from a Trump embracing populism kind of sense, the party will be permanently changed on a few sort of important issues. I mean, already, I think foreign policy adventurism for the Republican Party is kind of out the window now. That's partly Trump being the first guy to say it out loud, and partly that, 18 years later, we're still in Afghanistan, which 19. Is just, sorry, 19, which is just, bananas when you think about it, historically. And I think people are fed up with that. And weirdly, the foreign policy establishment in Washington, D.C. is still sort of, acting like nothing's going on here, and the Democratic Party weirdly doesn't seem to be invested in this. They made a big deal in the Iraq War being against this stuff, but I mean, Obama came in and fully continued that, and then no one said anything. So that's one issue. I think things were changed. Obviously immigration is going to be a big thing going forward, and obviously I think the Republican Party is, for the longest time, was seen as the de facto business party in this country. And I think that that's radically changed too. I mean, the Wall Street is Democratic now. Silicon Valley is Democratic. And with the power that those institutions are amassing and have, exhibited in the past decade, starting with the financial crisis, Republicans, I think the smarter ones, at least like Hawley and Cotton, have realized that there's, a lot to be gained politically by promising to protect voters from these oligarchs, essentially. And there are serious concerns there about how these people control information and our dollars.
Molly, we'll pick up on the topic of conservative populism as we listen to the Q&A with Mark and Molly Hemingway from the 2020 Virtual Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference right after the break.
the church's music from the second century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love and truth.
The sixth century. The 12th century. The 16th century. The 21st century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
You wish your classical school could do more for struggling learners, uncertain where to begin? The Memoria Press Schools Division includes Cheryl Swope, author of Simply Classical, A Beautiful Education for Any Child. The schools division will happily assist your school. Memoria Press offers an entire line of special needs resources for teaching math, reading, spelling, and more. Contact schools at memoriapress.com or order directly from simplyclassical.com with coupon code LPR23.
America's tradition of liberty depends on having colleges and universities that equip young people for the responsibilities of freedom. At Concordia University Chicago, freedom is a pillar of our education. We prepare our students to live as free, self-governing citizens. I'm Dr. Rachel Ferguson, Director of the Free Enterprise Center at Concordia Chicago. I invite you to visit us. Discover what it means for freedom to become a pillar of your future. Learn more at cuchicago.edu.
On this Tuesday, June the 6th, we're listening to the Q&A with Mark and Molly Hemingway from the 2020 Virtual Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. Here's Molly picking up on the subject of conservative populism.
I think it also relates to what we're seeing right now. Conservative populism is very winnable. We were told, 4 to 12 years ago that there was no path forward for Republican Party at a national level. That there was demographic destruction on display for Republicans. And what Donald Trump showed is that by being a conservative populist, you can win. And I think a lot of what you're seeing right now in terms of these attempts to incite racial strife is an attempt to destroy the Republican Party, because a lot of people see that they can be powerful if they are conservative and on behalf of the working man and whatnot. And if you look at it that way, it makes more sense why so many people in the media and other establishment areas are working so hard to incite this racism and racial strife.
Will either party going forward take up a pair of issues that were very popular and swept Republicans into legislative power in 1994, and that is legislative term limits? That goes along very nicely with Drain the Swamp, and a balanced budget. Take those apart, if you would, Mark.
Well,
why doesn't Trump run on legislative term?
Well, here's one of the negative things I would say about Trumpian populism is that any sort of fiscal austerity went out the window. The bottom line is that after decades of entitlement spending in this country and some of the systemic problems that politicians don't seem to want to address in a meaningful way, like neither Republican Party or the Democratic Party wants to actually deal with healthcare in a way that would, get the cost problem under control. People are just dependent on those things now. So, and some unholy percentage of the federal budget is 70-80% or whatever is just entitlement spending now. There's no way to do any sort of serious fiscal austerity in this country without making it hurt for almost everyone in the country. And this is a huge problem because we have, what, like a $20 trillion deficit right now, and we are one financial crisis away from the debt service wiping away all discretionary spending that Congress has. And, you know, then things would really start to get painful. I mean, I don't know if we're ever going to have any sort of fiscal austerity in this country until something bad happens, like, you know, Great Depression breadline level is going to happen. So that is one thing that's a problem. And I don't honestly know what to say about that. It just, it's an electoral loser. And if you want to get elected to office, I mean, I almost don't blame Republicans for, you know, just abandoning that issue, even though they, you know, fought it for a long time.
And I think it's a related thing with the term limits, which were a very popular issue, popular enough that several states enacted term limits and or people ran promising to term limit themselves. But because what happened in our constitutional system is something very non-constitutional, the removal of the running of the government from Congress into the executive branch, where you just have this massive administrative state that regulates everything, comes up with the regulations, enforces the regulations. It doesn't actually matter who you put into office because of how powerful the administrative state is. And I think people kind of instinctively know that now, and that it doesn't, you know, it wouldn't really matter if you term limited these members because they have, the institution of Congress has removed power from itself and given it over to, you know, HHS and, you know, Health and Human Services and all these other massive bureaucracies.
So the concept that is very foundational to the Constitution originally, which is legislative supremacy, no longer exists in any real form.
There's a good book on this that came out this year by Christopher Caldwell called The Age of Entitlement.
Yep.
And it's about how we're kind of currently operating two constitutional systems. The real constitution that we enacted hundreds of years ago, and then this administrative state that really was emboldened through the passage of the Civil Rights Act, but also so many other big pieces of legislation. I recommend that book.
How significant is it that Donald Trump has at long last canceled the GOP convention in any conventional form? Molly first, then Mark.
I think this is huge and hugely damaging to Trump. It is undoubtable that his success in 2016 was something you could observe through these large rallies that he was hosting, but it also kind of, these rallies built upon themselves to create excitement and an understanding among his voters that they would be voting for him, that it was okay to vote for him. And not having that, I think, also is bad for him. I think he gets a lot out of interacting with people, and he, you know, when he has these rallies, he like tests out ideas, which is something the media have never really understood. They just freak out over everything he says. But by playing them off of crowds, he kind of gets a feeling for what's good to say, what's popular, and whatnot. So I think it's bad. Conventions are very helpful to candidates, and not having them is very bad. Right now, Joe Biden has the backing of the entire establishment, including the very powerful media, and they seem to be operating a campaign of keep him in the basement, hide him, make you forget that there's a campaign going on. And the more they can make you forget that there's a campaign going on, the better it is for Biden. So I think this is not good for Trump.
From a practical standpoint, I mean, I agree with everything Molly just said. You know, it's particularly important for Republicans who don't have any sort of real purchase in the media landscape to have these events where they can sort of bypass the filters of the media. Having said all that, you know, I've been to half a dozen major national political conventions, and they are weirdly archaic institutions. They don't actually decide anything really at these conventions meaningfully anymore in terms of platforms and other stuff that once made a difference. And to the extent that they do anything like that, they can do that all online or virtually. They're just,
I love,
I don't
know, conventions.
I mean, they're fun for reporters, right? But they're like archaic and often a waste of, you know, money. You know, I think Trump would be, if Trump could just hold rallies and didn't necessarily have to have a convention, you know, that would serve him almost as well. But yeah, if we got rid of conventions in the State of the Union and the White House, you know, correspondence dinner, we'd all be better off.
I did interview him in May, and we talked about the lack of campaign events, and he was not happy about not being able to do them.
He personally feeds on those.
Yes.
Tim says, how do you guys think the whole Russia hoax / FBI spying thing is going to end up? It doesn't seem to have an end in sight. Molly, that's your bailiwick there.
Yes. I don't know how it's going to end. And I'm right now very worried that there will be no accountability coming from Durham, the prosecutor who's looking into it, or Barr, the attorney general. I mean, it's just very important that people be held accountable for this. What happened was absolutely wrong. It was that the Hillary Clinton campaign secretly bought and paid for a disinformation campaign that they peddled throughout the media, that they seeded into the federal government. That was bad enough. Then the federal government weaponized that. I mean, as we have learned, the more that what this disinformation was, it was really ludicrous, and nobody should have fallen for it. And it's hard to believe anyone did fall for it, which makes it seem more nefarious. But the federal government weaponized it, used it to spy on an opposing presidential campaign, and that was very bad. But it's also very bad that the media engaged in a co-conspiratorial relationship with these people. Now, you cannot convince me, however lacking an intelligence reporter might be, that they really believed that Donald Trump was a secret Russian agent. But they made that seem like it was a reasonable thing to believe, and they spent years. This was damaging to the Republic. It was extremely damaging to foreign relations. It undermined the proper administration of government. And there are so many different ways you could go after the people who were engaged in it. And if no one is held accountable, and also if Trump loses, it'll all have been worth it for these people. They got exactly what they needed. And there will be no accountability. So it is very bad. I am hopeful. I hope that there will be accountability, even if it's just a small measure of accountability relative to what should happen.
Well, I think there already has been some accountability in the sense that, you know, the media may not want to cover it, but we've had enough, you know, certainly within, thankfully, a growing partisan press at least, and, you know, the declassification of a lot of important documents or whatever that clearly show a lot of what happened. I mean, just in the last week, we learned that the primary source of the Steele dossier is this lunatic who made things up with an extensive history of public drunkenness.
I mean, the New York Times today writes a piece saying that this guy did so much out of service to his country, and Attorney General Barr has exposed him. You know, they are still engaged in this plot to redefine reality and redefine history. And the fact that the facts keep coming out, if the media don't cover them, and they don't, and they continue to lie about them, that is nothing. People actually need to go to jail. People need to be indicted. People need to not get multi-million-dollar book contracts and rewards and election wins.
I fundamentally agree, but I just think I still have some confidence over time from a historical perspective that, you know, facts are going to be hard to sweep under the rug. You know, official government documents that contradict all this stuff are going to be hard to sweep under the rug. Never mind that if you actually say you go back and you look at, you know, all these Pulitzer Prize winning stories in the New York Times, and then you read even the Mueller report, which was supposedly, you know, going to be the official document that was going to, you know, indict Trump, and it didn't. You'll see that even from the Mueller report, all the stuff the media was reporting was wrong. Our friend Lee Smith, who's done a lot of reporting on the Russia story, calls it an extinction level event for the media. And I think that is true to some extent. Yes, they're continuing the narrative in the face of that because they have no choice, you know, because they went so far out on that limb, they can't saw it off behind them. But the fact of the matter is that a huge portion of the country did see what happened with the Russia thing, did see that it was bunk, and they're going to have a hard time recovering, you know, credibility from that.
Cambria says, hi, Mark and Molly. In the wake of Black Lives Matter, many companies posted their support for the movement on social media, promising portions of revenue to support it financially. How do we as Christians navigate those choppy waters, especially since we patronize many of those organizations, some as simple as Target, she asked. Molly, your thoughts?
I do think it's important for Christians to stand up and have their voices heard, and we are in a great place to have our voices heard because of our religious objection to racism in all its forms. I was thinking about this yesterday when I was listening to the previous speakers too. I like to remember this one essay by Václav Havel, the former president of the Czech Republic, but before that, he was a playwright and essayist, and he had this essay called The Greengrocer Essay, or The Power of the Powerless. And it's all about how in totalitarian systems, everybody is supposed to put up a sign. In his case, it's a sign saying, "The workers of the world unite." And he discusses the meaning of that sign and how nobody actually knows what it means, but they know they're supposed to put it in their storefront so that the people above them know that they're not troublesome and the people below them know they can be trusted to be part of the party system. And that's what we have here in this country. We have everybody required to put up the sign in their storefront. In his essay, he talks about what happens when one person doesn't put up the sign and how disrupting to the totalitarian system it can be. I think this is what Christians are called to do, to not participate in evil systems or not participate in totalitarian systems, and to just decline to participate or to speak out in support of the proper way of thinking. It does take courage. I think you kind of practice it. You get better at it the more you practice. And being really focused on what's important, you know, and the gospel being more important than politics. But just working on it and being prepared. We know we're promised persecution as Christians, and we should expect that and just live our lives preparing for it.
We'll discuss corporate support for Black Lives Matters in our Q&A with Mark and Molly Hemingway from the 2020 Virtual Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference right after this break. I'm Todd Wilkin. Stay tuned.
Educating a new generation of Lutherans, you're listening to Issues Etc.
I am beautiful because I am fearfully and wonderfully made.
I am accepted because I'm a part of His family through Jesus' shed blood.
Unity Lutheran School in East St. Louis, Illinois, shines the light of Christ in one of the most impoverished cities in America. Learn how to support their mission work at unityesl.org. Unityesl.org.
Today, with the help of the Holy Spirit, I say yes to God in His ways.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're listening to a Q&A with Mark Hemingway, senior writer for Real Clear Investigations, and Molly Hemingway, Fox News contributor, editor-in-chief for The Federalist, and author of the books Rigged and Justice on Trial from the 2020 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. Our mutual friend, Pastor Matt Harrison, is the author of the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June called Take Courage, Encouraging Words for Discouraging Times. It's about courage to live, courage to confess, and courage to die. Find out more about it at our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, and order Take Courage, 1-800-325-3040. Our Q&A went on to discuss corporate support for Black Lives Matter.
I think it's, you know, unfortunately, it's like this situation in ascertaining what news you can trust. It's just a subject you're just going to have to get educated on. I mean, Black Lives Matter is kind of two different things. On one hand, it's this broadly shared sentiment, which is one thing. On the other hand, it's an actual like organization with an ideological platform behind it. And I don't know how to feel about it. I mean, there were some major corporations that gave money to Black Lives Matter, the organization, just sort of out of reflex when this all happened. And that was really bad because they are revolutionary Marxists who say on their website that they don't believe in the nuclear family. I mean, it's crazy that you give money to this organization. Having said that, I also saw that a lot of corporations shortly got wise to what was going on. And if you, they would say the issue a Black Lives Matter statement, but then you look, the corporation was actually donating to the United Negro College Fund or the local NAACP chapter, you know, organizations that I personally disagree with a lot of their political approach to national politics, but our grassroots organizations, you know, or and do good in their own ways. But having said that, increasingly there is an acceptance of a very sort of dogmatic view of racial injustice that is very ideological, that is, you know, I used to say that you're running around complaining about cultural Marxism was, you know, was the surest way to identify yourself as a right-wing nutjob. Well, these days, I mean, if you look at the bestsellers list and you look at these books, I actually gave an issue on Issues, Etc. recently about this in an article that I'd written. If you look at a lot of these popular books on racism now, White Fragility, How to Be an Anti-Racist, I mean, these are actually Marxist texts that are, you know.
Also racist.
You know, they're advocating actual, like, discrimination from the other side of things. And it's really toxic ideology. So you need, obviously racial injustice exists. Obviously we can all do more to work on that. But there are a lot of what's being mainstreamed right now is really toxic and literally Marxist. And you need to be aware of what's what.
But the question was about what can be done. And I think you do need to email, you do need to write, you need to also talk to your neighbors. Probably neighbors is the most important thing you can do. It's not fun or comfortable. I live in a very liberal neighborhood, and they were pushing these racist, anti-racist things that the neighborhood could do. And I spoke up and explained why some people don't agree with that. And I don't particularly love doing it, but I got a lot of great feedback from other neighbors who didn't have the courage to speak up. And we need to all do that if
yeah,
we can.
Not everybody's in a position to speak up, but that's the really important point. If you are in a position to speak up and can, you know, if you're at your corporate diversity seminar and they are saying things that, you know, seem obviously bananas, which is what's happening right now, you know, if you speak up, it can often break the dam. You know, a lot of times corporate HR departments and stuff just sort of accept stuff uncritically. Your child's, you know, teachers at school just accept whatever, you know, curricular thing was handed down the transom on this, and you need to speak up and let people know why this is bad.
Brad says the Democratic Party has captured nearly the entire black vote for decades and given the black community almost nothing in return. To me, this is the epitome of systemic racism. How is it that this problem has hung around the necks of the Republicans? What's your answer to that question, Molly?
Absolutely true that the black vote is almost monolithic in support of Democrats. Also true, and I was very wrong on this in 2016, I thought that Donald Trump would get less of the black vote than Mitt Romney did. He got more, and he was trending more and is trending more. And I do think that explains why the media are running this racism theme for their opposition to Trump. But it's not just, the only way it makes sense that Democrats have been able to keep a lock on this vote is that Republicans have not done a good job of reaching out to that vote as well. I do think that their previous way of being, which was interventionist wars and support for large corporations, were not really issues that a lot of black people felt particularly sympathetic with. This conservative populism is absolutely something that I think more black voters sympathize with, and particularly black male voters, which is where Republicans have had their biggest inroads. Women tend to vote Democrat in a way that correlates with their own family situation. So the more that they are in an intact family, the less likely they would be to vote Democrat. So as marriage declines, and it is declining in all races, sadly, but as marriage declines, women in particular tend to want to vote for the party that promises more support. So you can kind of have a marriage culture or a government culture, and that has political implications. And as people sort of let marriage fall into disrepair, that benefits the Democratic Party. And it also explains why Democrats are sort of okay with marriage declines, even though they're so disastrous for women and children, because it benefits them politically.
So, you know what polling suggests is the biggest indicator that a black person is willing to vote Republican? They don't go to church, which seems kind of shocking, but if you know how black churches operate within their communities, they've long been very, very politically active because they had to be, you know, pre-civil rights. I mean, that was like sort of the political power base in the black church, because they're otherwise shut out of traditional political avenues. So one way I would suggest of making inroads is, you know, the was it Martin Luther King that famously said, you know, the most segregated hour in American life was, you know, on Sunday mornings. I think if there were more Christian outreach between, you know, traditionally white church bodies or mostly white church bodies into black churches working within your own communities. You know, if you have a church that's in the suburbs or whatever, working with, you know, an inner city church that's, you know, more African American and trying to do, you know, not even trying to do ecumenical things. I think that would be a huge help in terms of reaching out. And the other thing I would say is, you know, as Molly highlighted, the conservative populism, until the COVID hit and it shot back up immediately, you know, Trump had achieved the lowest unemployment rate among African Americans. And what African Americans need more than anything is a strong economy and a good job market. And I think if Republicans can deliver on that, and I think conservative populism is uniquely poised to do that, because a lot of the things that is holding African Americans down is excessive regulation. And frankly, excessive regulation is responsible for a lot of the police brutality that the black community is subjected to. If conservatives can win on those issues, then and make it clear that they're doing this to help black people, and I think they sincerely are at this point in time, then that'll be a big help.
Molly, you were a presence on Twitter. For a lot of people, kind of a voice of sanity on Twitter. Can you comment on the effect of Twitter on the loss of anything like truth in the media and opinion being accepted as the only way news is disseminated to a modern audience?
I genuinely like Twitter, and it has been good for me. I got on there before we started the Federalist, and I was able to pitch ideas directly to editors, or editors would reach out to me to say, oh, I saw that tweet, could you turn that into a piece? I continue to use it as a journalist to solicit pieces from other people, to just learn what's going on. In general, though, I think Twitter is a bad, Twitter does not bring out the best in people. I'm not sure if it's that people allow themselves, I'm not sure what the chicken and the egg issue is there, but you see people behave poorly on Twitter. They become hateful, they insult each other, and they also form these echo chambers where they're performing for people of like mind. And that has not been healthy for journalism at all. Mark already referenced this with, if he could have a newspaper where people committed to not being on social media, that would be great. As a media critic, I also like Twitter, though, because it does show what I've always suspected, which is these people who present themselves as objective journalists are in fact left-wing activists. And any pretense that our journalistic field was objective has been totally obliterated by Twitter. And I think it's kind of good to know what you're dealing with. People always suspected the reason why abortion coverage was so uneven was because people had particular viewpoints. Well, now you don't need to suspect it. You can just go on Twitter and see people being very open about their embrace of abortion or any number of other issues. So I like the transparency. It has been bad for journalism in general, but it's good that people know what they're dealing with. And they didn't really quite understand what they were dealing with for decades, even as conservatives complained about media bias going back to like the 1950s.
Well, I agree with everything Molly just said with a small caveat, which is to say, I don't know whether Twitter is radicalizing people in a way that's unhealthy. Like before, when they didn't have all that direct echo chamber feedback, I think they
kept it together.
Journalists felt like they had more of an obligation to preach to a broader audience, because now all the feedback they get is, you know, like-minded. But yeah, it's absolutely a huge problem. It's really amazing how journalists treat Twitter like it's some private clubhouse instead of something that everybody can like see and read. And it's just like, you know, every day it's just scrolling your feed like, really? That's what you think? Or you're kidding me, right? But, you know, it is what it is.
Drew in Los Alamos, New Mexico is watching there. The main reason I will vote for Trump is the nomination of good judges, especially to the Supreme Court. Given that it seems the conservative judges often seem to fail in this vocation, do I really care who wins the election? Molly.
I went through a little bit of this myself with Gorsuch's Bostock decision, which was an abomination and ridiculous. And I generally liked Gorsuch, and I thought he should be, I mean, there was very little dissent among Republicans or people on the right about whether Gorsuch would be a fantastic justice or not. I think he really disappointed people, not just in the outcome, but the way he got there in this transgender-related ruling. And I was very depressed after that, as Mark can attest. I thought, because I've spent so much of my own career caring about judges. I wrote with my co-author Carrie Severino, Justice on Trial, which is the story of the Kavanaugh confirmation, and it deals so much with the history of nominations of judges going back again to the 50s. And my co-author, I was despairing with her, and she made a really good point, which was that, yes, this was a very bad decision from Gorsuch, but he is still, like, 9 times out of 10, someone who is not ruling the way Ruth Bader Ginsburg would rule. And not just 9 times out of 10, it's like 95 out of 100. He is a far, far, far better justice than Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And I think that it can be disappointing. You know, just yesterday, there was a ruling where a church in Nevada was pointing out that casinos have greater rights than churches do when it comes to reopening. And John Roberts sided with the liberal bloc to say, yeah, you have no recourse. And as disappointing as Roberts is, it's that liberal bloc that votes in lockstep on almost every issue that is of true concern. Yes, it can be frustrating that the originalist judges might come to a different outcome from each other, but it is nothing compared to that. The other thing I would point out, Trump has nominated 200 judges. And when you are raising someone to the Supreme Court, you can really only work with the judges that have already been placed. And so the ones that are currently there are there because of previous nominations to their federal court. The better the current nominations are, the better situated you are in 10 years or 15 years when those people will be elevated to the court. So it absolutely matters. And 1 out of 4 people who voted for Trump voted for him because of those nominations. And I think they are probably very happy about that.
You mentioned John Roberts. So with some recent decisions, I openly speculated that John Roberts is kind of positioning himself as the successor to Anthony Kennedy. What do you think, Mark?
I think somebody has a blackmailable material on him, is what I think. I mean, some of these decisions, you know, don't really make sense in terms of his worldview and other things like that. I think what's going on there is that John Roberts perceives as the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, it's his job to protect the institutional credibility of this court at a time when the credibility of every other institution in America, be it the White House, be it the legislature, you know, be it the federal bureaucracy, are all crumbling. And unfortunately, I think the things that he's doing to preserve that institutional credibility, he's overthinking everything. In fact, if anything, he's diminishing the credibility of the court by issuing these, you know, bizarre rulings or whatever that aren't necessarily based in any sort of aren't grounded in any sort of like fact or legal precedent. But, you know, at the same time, I don't know what to say. I mean, the judiciary is suffering from major problems. It's because it's more esoteric than Congress or the White House a lot. And people don't have, you know, fewer people have law degrees. They don't pay this as much attention. But we've just seen absolute Calvin ball coming from liberal jurists in this country. I mean, they're literally just interpreting anything, you know, and it's into, you know, ruling whatever they want for political ends. And I don't like where that ends up.
There have been, finally, a series of polls, and I'm sure there'll be more going into the November elections, showing two things about the quote-unquote silent majority that term has come back into vogue. And that is that, one, conservatives, more than progressives, feel very hesitant to talk about their opinions with neighbors, friends, especially in the workplace. And two, and it's related, that conservatives rather than progressives fear that there will be repercussions for holding their political opinions, especially with regard to their employment. I'd like your thoughts on that and a little encouragement for, if there is such a thing as a silent majority, for people to start to assert their opinions, Molly.
Those polls which I saw were not surprising, but very disheartening to see. And I think it's obvious that this is the situation we're in right now. Just last night, the teenager who was persecuted by the media for smiling quietly as a person antagonized him at the pro-life march, Nicholas Sandman, won a settlement from the Washington Post. He previously won a settlement from CNN. What the media have done in the last few years is create a structure whereby you are not allowed to express support for Republicans or their candidates without sort of putting yourself out there for violence or assault or destruction by the media or other mobs. That is a very bad situation. And it is our reality. And it would be one thing if it could go away at some point. It's not going away. They're coming for you. And so once you realize that, you kind of have to decide how you want to respond to that. Do you want to just succumb? Do you just want to follow what the media have to say about what you're allowed to believe? Or do you want to resist it in some way? And I think resistance is important for the powers that be with the media. And you can do that in a small way or a large way, whatever you're capable of doing, but it must be done. I personally had this experience with a piece I wrote where I explained why marriage is based on sexual distinctions. And I had never come out publicly before and explained why I believed what I did. I was scared to do it. I did it. I was, of course, called a bigot in response to this. And then I realized that was all that they had. I said, you know, do you want to keep talking or do you want to just call me a bigot? And basically, the response was, we just want to call you a bigot. And I realized, well, that's not so bad. Like, I can handle this and I can keep going. I think you need to say what your piece is, whatever it is, whether you are a Trump supporter or a Republican or a person who believes in particular viewpoints, like you're pro-life, you believe in marriage being a particular way, you believe sexual distinctions are real and exist, and you just do what you're capable of doing and then keep practicing it and provide support to other people who do it. That's actually a great way to build up these muscles, is when other people have the bravery to speak out, you just defend them and you support them and you come to their aid. It's also what you should do as a Christian.
Mark? You know, it's like that C.S. Lewis quote about how it's better to live under robber barons whose cruelty can be satiated than to live under omnipotent moral busybodies who will torment you without end, for they do so with the approval of their own conscience. That's kind of where we're at right now. You know, when people are motivated by those kinds of things, they're just not going to let up. I mean, I do think that these things do have, you know, do tend to burn themselves out, fortunately. But if you look at like what's going on right now on the left, so a couple of weeks back, a bunch of prominent, sort of we'll call them like free speech, inclined to support free speech liberals, issued this letter that they had all signed protesting against cancel culture. Barry Weiss was one of the signatures and a few other people. But even in the letter that they wrote protesting cancel culture and some of these, you know, negative trends, they declare in the letter that the biggest threat to free speech and all the things they're concerned about is actually right-wing populism. But we're also kind of concerned about what's going on our side of things. Like, even in their petition against cancel culture, these people are afraid of cancel culture. Like, I don't believe that, you know, the majority of the signatures on that list, you know, actually believe that, you know, people, you know, Republicans are the ones they have to worry about. But they have to say that so they can keep their sinecures at the Atlantic or the universities that they work for or the publications that they write for. So we've got to get to a point where people on the left that are scared of this stuff actually realize they're going to have to team up with people on the right. Because that's the only way you're going to be able to fight this stuff. I just saw a video the other day where Ted Wheeler, the mayor of Portland, who's, you know, I'd call him a progressive, but he's really more of a lunatic, went out to the protesters, the federal courthouse in Portland, where they've been doing all that damage. And he's been supporting the protesters, you know, relentlessly and publicly. And the protesters immediately yelled at him to resign. It's like, okay. I mean, these people are anarchists and they're just, you know, arsonists, literally and figuratively. They want to burn everything down.
You asked for something positive, mm-hmm. and we didn't really give that. I do want to say, I think people need to realize that I don't want people to just think, oh, we're part of a silent majority and we'll vote in November and everything will be fine. Because first off, that might not be true. And secondly, voting is not sufficient for what needs to happen. And being quiet is not working out well. And so people need to realize that they need to speak up and they need to defend their neighbor. And also, though we shouldn't put our trust in princes and we should not be confused about them. I'm not pessimistic, by the way, about things. I just don't want people to think that things are better than
And I would just add on the sort of more Christian end of things that those of us that go to church and have some sort of moral clarity and we make the effort to instill that in our children, I think you're going to see like positive things that actually come out of it. If you can, you know, be aware of what's going on in the world but not compromised by it, like people are going to see you and they're going to want to follow that kind of example where you're not, you know, constantly troubled by what's going on. I mean, a lot of what we're seeing is people in the streets that are anxious because, you know, their, you know, entire belief system is wrapped up in temporal politics and their entire security is wrapped up in temporal politics. And if you can step outside that, it's incredibly liberating and a lot of people are going to want to join you.
Journalist Mark Amali Hemingway from the 2020 Virtual Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. Wednesday on Issues Etc. We'll look forward to Sunday morning, according to the one-year lectionary, talking with Pastor Peter Bender about the rich man and Lazarus from Luke chapter 16. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.